been recruiting for the rebellion for a long time.
We destroyed our home. I fight the Empire now.
I fear nothing. All is as the Force wills it.
The captain says you are a friend. I will not kill you.
Thanks.
There isn't much time.
All right, welcome to Logic Gate, where we are discussing the Star Wars TV show Andor on Disney Plus. I'm your host, Scott. Today I'm joined by my two friends, Doug.
Hello.
And Jason.
Hello.
So as a follow-up to the end of season one of Andor, we have gone back and actually watched Rogue One, the, I guess, prequel film to... I guess it's not a prequel film, it's a sequel to Andor? Whatever, anyway. So we have watched the film Rogue One, and we are going to discuss some of the things, some of the themes in the movie. This will not be a Rogue One extensive review, as that has been done many other places. We're going to try and stick to how Rogue One ties into the Andor television show, perhaps go into some theories for season two. How do you guys want to do this? I have some notes. I mean, I can go through what I came up with, through Andor, and we can just go back and forth, or did you guys have something else in mind?
Well, I did just kind of want to state here at the front end of this recording, whatever Nuge says negative about K2SO is patentedly untrue and wrong.
So just from the gate? Okay.
Yeah, let's just get that out there. I just want to put that down.
Way to poison the well, Doug.
So it is worth noting.
Well, I think the ultimate project or goal of this is to like see how Andor has changed our viewpoint of Rogue One. Because me particularly, I was not a fan of Rogue One, and Tony Gilroy put in a lot of effort into this project that kind of leads up to Rogue One. You'd think this would help like boost and build upon the movie, and maybe it would come out looking different after that. So that's kind of my goal going into watching it, really.
So what I refresh my memory, or what you were telling me, was that Rogue One was written and the majority of it was filmed, and I think the studio got a hold of it and they didn't like it, and that they called Tony Gilroy in to do some script doctoring, and then they went back and refilmed part of it. Is that true?
From what I understand, he was actually like a staff writer on the movie throughout production. They ended production and started post-production in 2016. And then they did a bunch of like a ton of reshoots in the summer of that year. Rumor is that they did about 50% of the movie, or redid about 50% of the movie. And that's what gave Tony Gilroy like a full writer story by credit, because he did at least 50%, I think, according to like the Writers Guild and all that stuff. So yeah, it had like a fairly tumultuous production, it seems.
So originally this was not a Tony Gilroy story, but it sounds like he got called in after the fact, perhaps to come in and clean it up. So as of right now, as of 2023, there's only been two non-core Star Wars movies. There's been the Han Solo movie and Rogue One. And I think it goes without saying, everyone I've talked to except for Jason absolutely loved Rogue One. I thought it was a great film. And so before the Andor TV show even came out, we were all discussing, and Jason was talking about how much he hated Rogue One, but he really liked the idea of what they were doing with Andor. And so he got us all to watch Andor. So clearly we've all watched season one of Andor. We all really liked it. And so we've decided to go back and rewatch Rogue One specifically just to make Jason squirm, because he hated it so much the first time. So we'll see if having watched season one of Andor is perhaps changed any of his mind on Rogue One. So I will go through some of my notes. Feel free to stop me. I want to try and keep this specifically related to Andor. Again, I don't want to go super deep in the weeds about the themes of Rogue One and everything else, because I feel like that's been done. So the first thing that I noticed, or that the first note that I took, was that when Kremik is first, the very first scene when he's trying to take Galen Erso in, he Krennic has a line that the Death Star is designed to keep the galaxy safe.
What is it you want?
The work has stalled. I need you to come back.
I won't do it, Krennic.
We were on the verge of greatness. We were this close to providing peace, security for the galaxy.
You're confusing peace with terror.
Well, you have to start somewhere.
He's implying essentially that it's not a weapon that I think, at least the way he views it, or the way that the Empire is trying to sell it, is that the Death Star is not an offensive thing, that it's more of a defensive thing. And I thought that was kind of interesting. It seemed analogous to me, like, doesn't the U.S. have something insane, like 12, you know, gigantic aircraft carriers, and the next largest army in the world has like two? Does that sound familiar to you guys?
Yeah, the military difference between the U.S. and other countries is ridiculous. And that's an interesting perspective, looking at it like, you know, the whole peace through superior force type of notion. I hadn't really considered that. Mostly what I was picking up from Krennic wasn't necessarily that he viewed it as a step towards peace, but he was willing to lie and delude himself and say the talking points. He seemed more power and ambition focused. It's difficult, though, because I've also seen the movie and I know where his character goes. So,
well, so my first thought when he said that line was, you know, he's trying to sell Galen Erso on, hey, no, man, we're not going to go kill a bunch of people. This is to keep the galaxy safe. So my first thought was, oh, that's hilarious. Like, this guy's clearly deluded. But then I started thinking about, you know, our situation in the United States. Like, I mean, that's essentially what we're doing, right? I mean, we're not too far off from this. I mean, we have by far the biggest military in the world by, you know, almost an order of magnitude. So I don't know. In some weird way, maybe that relates. I just thought it was a weird line that they have this gigantic Death Star and they're like, no, it's not a weapon. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Lucas has actually explicitly said when he did the original trilogy, that it was an sort of an analogous to the Viet Cong situation and the U.S. Imperialism. Represented by the Empire. I mean, he's been pretty explicit about that comparison. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, I hadn't heard that. The first scene we see, and I'm going to be jumping around here a lot. The first scene with Cassian, we see that he is running through some alleys and he gets caught up with some stormtroopers. And I did make a note that the very first time you see Cassian, he just straight up executes a stormtrooper who's chasing him, like no hesitation. And then he's also telling his, you know, quote unquote friend, he's like trying to calm him down, like, don't worry, it's not going to be a big deal. And then he shoots his friend in the back. So there was, you know, essentially, I think that's an extension of his character in Andor. So that was one of the things that I took away, was that they expanded on Cassian's, I guess, lack of remorse, where he just straight up shoots first a couple times.
Yeah. So this is one of the very few Cassian character moments that we can like even discuss, and how like maybe Andor has affected our viewing of this. You know, I guess I'll reveal my hand. I don't think there's very much character development in the movie. I don't think Cassian is a very good character in this movie, but to see him in this state, I did develop a new appreciation for this situation. Although I don't like to see him in this position, but he seems to be willing to do anything for the rebels at this point. He seems to be fairly cold-blooded. And then he makes a bit of a turn later on, which I appreciate. But yeah, this moment is a somewhat telling moment for him as a character who is kind of willing to do anything. Just murders this informant kind of out of nowhere. It felt a little awkward, even just like what was going on. Like, it didn't seem like he needed to do that. It just seemed like the guy was like whining, I can't get out of here, my leg's working. It seemed like he was just trying to stop him from whining. I don't know. What was your guys' take on that?
It sort of reminded me of the very first episode when he just straight up executes those two corpo guards in the alley. I mean, didn't we kind of say, like, did he really need to execute that other guy? Like, he couldn't have just run, like, but it seemed like maybe that's where they were going with it, is that this guy's conscience isn't the greatest, right? He doesn't get hung up on good versus evil or right versus wrong. Like, he's kind of out for himself, right?
Yeah, and but we get to develop that instance as in the TV show. I mean, that is fully developed. He murders those two Primo guards, and that has major repercussions. If he didn't, he'd probably be caught a lot sooner, or he'd be, you know, it would have been worse for him, I think. So we get to see like the ramifications and the reasoning. And here it just seems to be a character indication as, oh, it's kind of like Han shot first type of thing.
I mean, it is worth noting that Rogue One is not the Cassian Andor story. I mean, he is a secondary character in this, you know, so everything we learn about his character is, you know, sort of through the eyes of Jyn Erso, who's the main character. So, I mean, Andor is a spinoff of a spinoff show, you know, so it's kind of weird that this, you know, second rate character got his own show. So there's going to be parts where that are Cassian heavy, and then there are going to be parts that are not Cassian.
He's clearly like the second lead. I mean, he's a lead character. Yeah. Yeah, and he's
for sure
pretty important, but yeah, okay. We can. I don't know, Doug. What do you think about him shooting this informant?
So, what I actually saw with not just that scene, but the whole lead-in scene, was very Tony Gilroy-esque. I can't specifically say like, oh, Tony for sure wrote this, but it felt very similar because it was very heavily show don't tell. A lot of exposition came through in the beginning, learning who these characters are, learning what their motivations are, learning what their values are, and we're shown it. It's not explained to us. It's not stated. We get to see it through the exposition. Okay, Cassian's a rebel. He's against the Empire. He's gathering information, and he's willing to do whatever it takes to, you know, complete the mission, even if that amounts to executing someone because there's suddenly a liability that will prevent him from escaping. It's all very Tony Gilroy, a lot of what we saw in Andor. What I do note about this, though, is I know they have limits on runtime, and so some of this stuff has to get rushed. This might have been an instance where a little bit more exposition on Cassian and understanding his backstory would make more sense. But that said, having watched season one of the show, okay, I understand why he's reacting like this. I understand why he's executing an ally. It makes more sense. I have that character backstory on him. So that was kind of my perspective. It felt rushed, but having seen season one, it felt right.
Yeah, it feels weird out of the gate to see this, like, almost villainous behavior from one of the main leads. But to have that backstory, it does add a sense that things have gotten more desperate and, like, it has gotten really desperate, even more desperate than at the beginning of Andor. Like, all of the rebels kind of show how far things have gotten. So, yeah, I did see a little, or I did appreciate that a little bit differently. You know, so yeah.
I think you're totally right, Doug. Now that you say that, that does feel like a Tony Gilroy style of storytelling. And it's right out of the gate, too. I mean, what are we, second scene in the movie? So yeah. If indeed the script was written and he had to come back in and rewrite part of it, yeah, I'm almost positive you're right. That is probably a scene that he wrote. The next note that I have is Cassian is now referred to as Captain Cassian Andor Rebel Intelligence. So that he's called that by Mon Mothma. So he has an official title now. He's a captain of Rebel Intelligence, whatever that means. So clearly it's official that he is in the rebellion. He is a high-ranking official because he's working directly with Mon Mothma. And he is called in to interrogate Jyn. Cassian is aware of Galen and his involvement with the Death Star. So Cassian is essentially trying to get information out of Jyn about where her father is so that it's not clear at this point what he's going to do, but I mean, he either wants to interrogate him or kill him or do something.
Well, there was the pilot that was supposedly sent by Galen, and he's captured at Saw Gerrera's place. And so that's what this hubbub is about, because they're trying to they're trying to find more information or talk to Jin and see if like she can help maybe talk to Saw and like, you know, confirm this information and maybe like because she's related, you know, she was raised by Saw supposedly. So
where is Jin Erso during Andor? I mean, is it possible? And I wrote down, could Jin appear in season two? Because season one of Andor is what? What did we say? 5 years before Rogue One and New Hope?
Yeah. I think that was right.
So if I don't know how old Jin is supposed to be in Rogue One, let's say 25, maybe 30. So she would be in her 20s in Andor. So that would mean it would be possible that Cassie, well, he would have recognized her when he goes to interrogate her. So it'd be weird if she showed up in season two.
It strikes me as one of those Easter eggs that they might try and throw in because the studio wants to like, oh, fans will love this. And no, the fans will be annoyed by that. Me, I'm the fan. I would be annoyed.
I mean, you
by
could
it.
See something about Saw's relationship with Jin and not connecting to Andor. Because we kind of assume that Saw's going to still be in Andor. That would be really interesting, I think, to actually see more of Jin's story. Because you know, we kind of skipped over it. I know we're not going through the whole thing beat by beat, but it was like, it was kind of confusing and like really sparse for what happened to her, like as far as getting her to this spot.
Well, I mean, yeah, it opens with Jin as, you know, what, an 8-year-old, and then next thing we see her and she's, you know, late 20s. So there's clearly a big hole in her backstory. So, yeah, maybe it's possible. Maybe they could have a Saw and, well, no, hang on, because it comes up to that later. So I don't want to – we'll get to that in a second. It may not work out.
Hold on just a minute, because there's a point that we're about to just blow right past, and I think we need to acknowledge it. When prior to the whole scene with Cassian interrogating Jin, we are introduced to the greatest droid in the entire Star Wars franchise in possibly the coolest fashion ever when he just grabs Jin by the throat and throws her down on the ground. K2.
Yeah.
Best droid ever.
Okay. Well, I agree. I think he's like a really good.
Wait. Hang on one second. I don't think my mic, your mic must have cut out. Can you say that one more time?
I mostly agree. I think he's probably the highlight of the whole movie. I mean, he's, you know, he's really funny and it makes total sense for a droid character to be, you know, this Empire droid. I'm not sure what type of droid it is, but like, being reprogrammed and like and having kind of like no filter and you don't get the sense that they're trying to like support it emotionally, right? But you can
was he reprogrammed?
Yeah.
I don't remember. Yeah. I don't know his, what was the backstory? I missed that.
That he was a reprogrammed Imperial droid.
So that, okay.
That's literally all they said.
So the rebels got a hold of an Imperial droid and reprogrammed. They reflashed his firmware, essentially.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. All right, that makes sense. That's what I took away. I was wondering if there was more that I had missed.
Nope, there's not a lot. But I think it's a good example of a droid in Star Wars. It performs sort of like a function. It's helpful. That there's no acknowledgement that it's like got emotions or like it's got hurt feelings, but you still sympathize with, you can't help but feel affection toward it.
Yeah, like, just, like his,
especially at the end, you know, but yeah.
Yeah, his death scene is brutal,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, it's a great
scene. I mean, he takes two shots and he's, you know, in the front and the back and he saves the day and he collapses on the panel. Like, dude, I mean, yeah, again, it's just a droid, but man, that was tough. Like, because he's such a cool character.
We're just going all out with the spoilers, by the way. We're not even going to give a warning on that.
Dude, if you haven't seen Rogue One and you're listening to episode 14 of our Andor podcast, then you're on your own.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to go through the whole thing beat by beat, but I did. So I did notice something about his death. He was the only death that I cared about, by the way. he's the only person that seems to be fighting to the end of his death. which is more impactful. All the other characters, I mean, whether it's kind of their choice or not in the storytelling, they kind of just let it happen. It happens so many times. Like a bomb is thrown and they're sitting and they just like, oh, I guess this is it. Or with Saw's case, it's like the most extreme version of like, I guess I just won't get on this ship. So, and I think it's on purpose because it's less impactful deaths. You know, it's kind of risky to have such prominent deaths in a Star Wars show. And I'm guessing that was impetus from like the studio or the Kathleen Kennedy to kind of, because it you know, if you see some character like fighting to the end, it's more heavy and it's more impactful. But so many times we see characters in this just kind of resign and let it happen. So
yeah, I would also point out that there's a drastic difference between us watching K2 fight till the end and watching any actual person fight to the end. That's probably the difference between what was this, a PG rating and like a PG-13 or an R. Mm-hmm. If we watched Andor, like Cassian, get hit multiple times, blasters and like you know, holes in his body and blood and, you know, that's a bit too graphic.
Well, okay.
You could show it happening to a robot all day long.
An example is when the pilot, Bodhi, I think, he's in the ship and there's a grenade that gets thrown into the ship. And he just looks at it and smiles and the ship gets blown up. It's like, if you saw him scrambling to go after that grenade, that would be way more impactful. It would be more brutal. You're not showing any extra violence. It's just showing that the character isn't like magically resigned to this fate, you know, type thing, which...
The same thing happens to the chain gun guy, right?
Like yes.
The grenade kind of... The
exact same
and
thing.
He rolls down the beach and he realizes he can't get to it. So he just kind of accepts his fate.
Yeah, it's just something I noticed. And I think that's why K2's death is the most impactful in the movie.
He's also an extremely likable character, and I guess some of the other characters are. Like, Cassian is not a particularly likable character in this, and Jyn Erso, not a particularly likable character.
That's what I'm saying, dude.
Yeah,
I mean, that's all I'm saying, and I think that's like the most important thing in a movie is like characters that you kind of like or at least feel like are explored. Okay.
Different perspective on the character deaths, though, because I do see the trend that you're referring to, but I didn't see that as them all just kind of giving up, like, well, we're not going to win this fight, might as well die. I saw it as an acknowledgement of, you know, fulfillment, like, okay, I'm dying, but at least I've completed my mission or done the best that I can. I can go out happy with myself.
Sure.
I see that as victory. I see that as a win.
Yeah.
You see that as weakness, failure, giving up.
Like, so the chain gun guy's
name is...
Is
that a quote from something? Is that a reference? It sounds like a reference.
That's not a reference, okay. But
it's a good quote.
You live in a dark world, dude.
The chain gun guy's name is Baze Malbus. And he, like, because after his buddy, you know, the blind guy gets killed, he realizes he doesn't have a lot left. And when he just, like, walks out with his chain gun... And just like essentially walks into the thick of things and starts executing guys. I mean, he takes out like five guys before they take him down. That was a pretty badass death scene.
I remembered it differently. I thought he was able to like go guns blazing in that moment, but he like shoots one shot and then has to like cock the gun and reload.
Yeah, he had to like cock like a shotgun. That was weird.
What? Because we see him earlier going like full automatic.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think that was like more of an artistic choice because like watching your hero cock the gun, that's like a cool
pose. It was 100% like, for cool factor.
I think they just wanted to show him looking cool.
It could be explained like he's running out of energy or he's running out of like juice or whatever. That you could explain that, but they didn't, and so it seemed weird.
I don't think that was a Tony Gilroy scene.
Maybe let's circle back to the plot. So the next note that I had was that Mon Mothma calls Saw Gerrera an extremist. So she does not consider Saw Gerrera a part of the Rebel Alliance. So I don't know if I really got the impression that he was an extremist in Andor. So I have a feeling I have a feeling that Saw Gerrera is going to come back in season two, and we're going to see a lot of him, his character development, assuming they can get Forest Whitaker. So, the first time we see Saw is you actually see his feet first, and you see that he has a metal foot and a partly metal leg as well. So he's had some serious damage. He also has some sort of Vader-like suit, you know, with a oxygen mask on it to keep him alive. He's clearly not in good health. Certainly not as good health as he was in Andor. So something certainly happens to Saw in, between Andor and this. There was some discussion on the Andor subreddit that we were going to see Saw Gerrera get betrayed. And that's why he's so damaged, is that, you know, he runs a mission and somebody turns traitor and he gets hurt, but somehow survives. So that was one difference I saw, is that the Saw Gerrera character is significantly different. In fact, Saw has a great line. He's talking to Jin and he says, "There's not much of me left." So he's implying that he's seen some better days.
Yeah, he's got the oxygen thing. It's kind of weird. It's weird because in the trailers, he was all bald. All the scenes of him were bald, and I'm guessing that he grew his hair out, and that's when they had to do the reshoots.
Oh, interesting.
Because most of this is showing him with hair, other than the one quick peek of him peeking through the hole where Jin is hiding. He's bald there, so I guess you assume that like he grew his hair out later on.
I will say, I didn't catch the detail about him being bald versus with hair, but I did notice that something looked off with him.
Can you elaborate?
Yeah, it's Forrest Whitaker. He's got a lazy eye. Something looked off. Okay.
Okay. Just making sure. Mon Mothma makes mention, after she calls Saw Gerrera an extremist, that Saw has been attacking cargo shipments. So whatever he's doing is he's still poking at the Empire. Saw makes mention that the weapon, he doesn't know that it's called the Death Star. He says that the weapon is powered by kyber crystals. So the implication here, or Mon Mothma is implying that Saw Gerrera is attacking cargo shipments that are going, I assume, to the construction of the Death Star. So he is attempting to, I think, destroy ships of kyber crystals so that it can't power the Death Star. Chirrut Imwe has a line in the movie. He says, "The strongest stars have hearts of kyber." So I don't know a whole lot about the Death Star's power source. Do they ever make mention that it's powered by kyber crystals?
They do. In the movie Rogue One, they talk about how it's powered by kyber crystals.
Who says? I mean, when is that? Did I miss it?
I believe Saw Gerrera, does he say something about that?
I'm just wondering if the Empire actually confirms that. Anyway, it's not important, but it's worth noting that lightsabers are powered by kyber crystals, and so are the Death Star, apparently, so... And apparently, I guess I should do some research on kyber crystals, but I mean, do they come from the hearts of stars? I don't know.
So what I understand after kind of like watching some videos on this is that Saw is in this area protecting the source of the, like kyber crystal mines, because this is like considered the holy city. And I guess it's important to the old religion of Jedi. And that's why you see Chirrut and Baze there as like they're supposedly, I think, the guardian of the wills.
Oh, that would make sense. Like if they're old school Jedi or whatever, because the crystals are supposed to go to Jedi, the peacekeepers of the world, that they wouldn't want them, you know, taken to, you know, mm-hmm. have a massive weapon used by your foes, apparently.
Yeah, I think that's the extent of Saw Gerrera's involvement, is he's just trying to protect the Holy Land type of thing.
Okay, so that's what Saw's been up to. He's not as young and healthy as he used to be, but he's still doing his part by trying to keep the Empire from getting the kyber crystals. I noted that Rogue One is very much a Star Wars movie. There are multiple different alien races. There's spaceship battles. There's a lot of action. I think we had said that Andor didn't necessarily feel like a Star Wars show. It really was a political intrigue show set in the Star Wars universe. So just the one difference I noticed on this movie was this was much less political intrigue and much more action oriented.
Well, yeah, but I would also point out this was the very first foray into a Star Wars film without the core Star Wars stuff. There were no Skywalkers. There were no Jedis. It was their first Star Wars movie that branched off. So I think they tested the waters a little bit, but they weren't ready to just go full deep end.
Yeah, it hits a lot of the beats of TIE fighters, Star Destroyers, Darth Vader.
But it doesn't hit all the beats. It hits some of them.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does mention Obi-Wan, and it does mention, well, actually, Leia's in it, and they mention that, so it's like...
When do they mention Obi-Wan?
Jimmy Schmitz, I can't remember his character.
Oh, but right.
He says,
Bail Organa?
Yeah. He just mentions that he's going to use Leia.
Did you just scoff that I knew his name?
No, I just think it's...
Impressive? I think so, yes.
I'm well impressed, done. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I took note that there were essentially six main locations in Rogue One, mostly planets, but I'm going to read them out. And then Scarif, obviously, Edu, Jeddah, Yavin 4, Wobani, the Ring of Khafrin, and Lamu. So none of those, at least to the best of my knowledge, were locations or were even really discussed in Andor. So there may be a possibility for one of those locations to come up in season two. Maybe there's some discussion of what's going on in Scarif, or those are all possibilities because it has not been part of the TV series as of yet.
It would make sense that Jeddah would come up, the city that gets blown up, because that's it's at least important to Saw. So that could be, yeah.
I wrote down K2SO is my favorite droid in the series. I think we already talked about that. He's just such a great character. And he's really kind of, I mean, he's more human than a lot of the human characters. Like, for lack of a better word, like, Cassian is kind of stiff and kind of, I don't want to say robotic, but he doesn't have a lot of emotion, right? Whereas you look at K2, who is a legitimate droid, and he's got way more of a sense of humor and way more of a, I want to say a purpose, right? I was just very impressed with seeing K2 do his thing again. And Tudyk does an amazing job voicing him.
Yeah, I was kind of curious going into this if this was, if he was still going to hold up as being as cool and funny as I remembered, if I was kind of being a bit nostalgic. And no, I'm happy to say, at least from my perspective, he held up. Like, the character was still amazingly great.
Do you think, is there going to be any connection to K2 in season two of Andor?
I'd be on board for that.
I seem to remember Tony actually saying as such that he is going to include him. I think he said that. I don't remember exactly where, but yeah, I think so. Okay. It would make a lot of sense because you see that droid.
Where's K2's introduction in Rogue One? Is he just with the rebels when they're interrogating Jyn when they all get together?
No, he first shows up outside the prison transport as Jyn is about to escape, and he grabs her and throws her on the ground.
Congratulations. You are being rescued. Please do not resist.
Oh, right. So it is possible, because at this point in Rogue One, Cassian's been working with the Rebels for a while, so it's possible that K2 has been working with the Rebels. It's possible that whole squad has been working together for a couple years, so we could see some of those beats come in Season 2. We could see Chirrut Emway, we could see Baze, we could see...
No, I don't think so. We just meet them. Andor just meets Chirrut and Baze in this... Which is kind of weird. They just kind of start tagging along.
Where does... Oh, that's right. He meets them on the planet. I was thinking they were part of... You're right. I was thinking they were part of the Rebel Alliance. You're right.
What I find interesting is, like, the Mon Mothma and the scenes in the Rebel, like, headquarters. And I'm really curious because I got a whole lot of new context there of, like, we're seeing Mon Mothma in a whole new position. I was really... this was, like, probably one of the most new... revelatory moments is seeing Mon Mothma in this new position and like how where she's gotten to this point, but it also you can tell that there's a lot of disagreement in the rebel groups, and she seems, you know, first time seeing this, all the characters seem like jaded and resigned and like super boring, but it makes sense for her to have gone through this whole sacrifice she's done with her family and being in this position where it's not even working out that well when Jin is trying to plead with her to say, we need to get all the rebels to go to Scarif and steal these plans. She can't convince any of the other rebels. They're all just disagreeing, you know, and so she's just like, I guess we can't do it. Although that, I mean, I guess they changed their mind once Jin and Cassian decide to do it on their own with their own group later, but. Yeah, so I found that interesting.
I had two notes about that scene with Mon Mothma. Number one is that the same actress that plays Mon Mothma in Rogue One as in Andor. So Genevieve O'Reilly comes back to play Mon Mothma again. So Rogue One came out in 2016 and Andor came out in 2022. So, I mean, there is 6 years between that, but they were able to get her to come back.
Yeah, she looks good.
Yeah. Well, she has a really small part in Rogue One. I mean, I think she's got like, what, 3 lines, 4 lines? I mean, she does that, you know, that scene you were just talking about, and that's pretty much it. She was a tiny character in New Hope. She was a small character in this, and she's a major character in Andor, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty much like first time seeing this movie, she was pretty much a nothing character. Just like, hey, look, it's Mon Mothma. But under the surface, I appreciated kind of what was going on. Now that I've seen her character and all the sacrifices she's made to get to this point and how poorly it's going for her, basically, like it's a rough situation. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the other thing that I noted was that, I mean, what's the rebellion? I mean, they're organized in that they have this group and they're all meeting and they have somewhat of a fleet, but they are not big. They haven't really had a win. Like you said, Mon Mothma couldn't convince them to go and do this thing. So the rebellion really doesn't exist. So the way in my mind, I think the attack on the Death Star is the first big win for the for the rebellion. I guess you could argue maybe getting the plans is a pretty big win for them. I mean, as far as like recruitment and putting them on the map, like if I was just some guy and I was choosing whether or not I was going to go up against the Empire, like you gotta, what's on your resume? Like make me want to come and be on your team. Like the rebellion doesn't have a whole lot going for it right now.
Yeah. I mean, they're definitely more of a force than they are in Andor in this movie. You know, there's something that the Empire is fully aware of, and they're even kind of feared in some senses. Like they really, especially Krennic, there's a moment that I appreciated when he's looking out over Scarif and he's seen all the bombs exploding, and you could see the fear in his face, and because it kind of looks like there's more people there than they are. So I think, you know, they're a ragtag team, but they've really made an impression on the Empire as like something to be really feared, I guess, at this point in the story.
I did make mention that, and I'm going to say it again, Grand Moff Tarkin is in this. And, you know, he's a CG character because the actor that played him died. And is it just like it looks terrible, right? I mean, like it looks, as you know, it looks good-ish. But it just looks like creepy.
That's something that it actually looked a lot worse to me this time around than the first time. I think it has aged very poorly.
Go ahead, Doug.
I was curious about that myself because I remember that being one of the talking points the first time around. But I went into it the first time watching it knowing that that was going to come up. And so when I saw him on screen the very first time that I watched it, I do remember having the thought, okay, you know, it's not perfect, but that's pretty decent. I watched the movie with my wife. I didn't say anything to her. I didn't know if she knew or not. But after the scene, I paused it and asked her, like, did you notice anything off, you know, anything unusual or weird about that previous scene? And no, she didn't. She didn't even notice that he wasn't a real person.
I did the exact same thing with my wife and had the same reaction. I don't think she was paying super close attention, but I was like, look at that. Does that look weird? She was like, I don't know. And yeah. I don't know. It just bugged me. This came out right about the same time that Terminator movie came out, and they tried to make Arnold Schwarzenegger young. And then they did that Will Smith movie where they tried to make him young too. And they all just look like garbage, dude. Just stop doing that. Go find another actor that looks sort of kind of like him. Put a wig on him and be done. Cause like, it just looked bad.
Yeah. It ages. It just ages so poorly.
Yeah.
You can tell that they're trying to compensate for like the dead eyes and the dead face. Yeah. By making them kind of like twitch a little bit, like the face kind of makes like little twitches and like little inflections, but it all just looks so unnatural. It's like totally uncanny valley. And Leia, I think, is that whole thing is just so, it's like an abomination.
But I think the point that I'm making, though, is that, yeah, it's noticeable if you know that it's there.
Yeah.
If you don't, like Baker's wife, like my wife, you just don't pay attention to it. It doesn't bother you. Like,
yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
It's kind of, is it A-plus material? No, but it's a passing grade.
Well, yeah. I don't think we need to.
Yeah, I give it a solid C, right.
I don't,
right.
I'm like kind of morally against it. I think I'm actually like, I don't want Hollywood to be able to get away with just digitizing actors going forward. Like, I mean, they may be able to get away with it and may look okay enough. But, like, they could have just hired someone that kind of looked like Tarkin, like an actual actor. I don't like...
I will point out, this is not exploitation, as you're like, oh, the poor actors, won't someone think... There's still a voice actor who had to play the part, and there were several people they had to hire to animate the character. So, this was the more expensive route.
What do you think about... Did you guys hear about James Earl Jones has signed over the likeness of his voice to LucasArts to voice Vader in the future?
Oh, really?
Because he's 90. He's not going to live forever, right?
Yes, he will.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, there's a voice actor. That may not be the case in the future. And I just kind of, I don't like it. I don't like the idea of like resurrecting dead actors or just like taking a scan of Tom Cruise and like he doesn't even have to do anything. They can just do a movie with Tom Cruise. I don't know. I just don't. It just doesn't sit right.
All right. I don't want to get hung up on that, but it bugged me when I watched it the first time, and it bugged me this time. I made a note that making Chirrut Imoy blind is a cool twist. And I don't know if I put this together the first time, but in Phantom Menace in episode 1, Qui-Gon makes mention that the Force allows Anakin to see things before they happen, which is why he's able to pilot the speeder so well. And I wonder if that's what they were trying to lead into with Chirrut Imoy, because I don't know if it's ever said if he's a Jedi or not, but he certainly talks about the Force enough that I wonder if perhaps he uses his Force sight, or, you know, the Force essentially gives you kind of like a spidey sense where you can sense things that are happening even if perhaps you can't see them. So I thought that was kind of cool. And he shoots a damn X-Wing out of the air with a bow and arrow. How freaking cool was that?
That was a cool scene, yeah. I think it was a TIE Fighter.
TIE Fighter. There, when Jyn finally meets up with Saw, she mentions that she hasn't seen Saw in a long time. And, you know, clearly his health isn't the best. And she says that Saw abandoned Jyn when she was 16. Saw basically says, oh, I wasn't worried about you. You were my best soldier. So, I mean, clearly Saw raised her, but she's going to even have abandonment issues from Saw as well, because he left her when she was 16. So between age 16 and, you know, however old she is in this, we don't know her backstory.
Yeah, do you think it was a little weird, the kind of lack of – it seemed like there was a lack of emotion with Jyn when Saw died, even though they're supposedly had like a long history of her, like he should be more important to her than her father, really, because he's
kind of like an adoptive father, right? I mean, essentially, he raised her from 8 to 16. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I just found it a little weird and kind of weak, but yeah.
the scene where Cassian escapes off of Jeddah and he pilots up into the atmosphere to avoid the Death Star attack. Did you guys note that that was very similar to the scene where he's piloting through the atmosphere in the eye?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the same angle, you know, I mean, there's not necessarily meteors flying around, but it was almost like kind of shot for shot. It was pretty cool looking. You know, K2SO was making the calculations instead of the guy from Andor, obviously, but that was a nice nod to Andor, or I guess vice versa, since it was the other way. But
I meant to throw these in earlier, but just since we're talking about nods, I also found it interesting that there's some parallels, a couple of parallels. Like Cassian loses his family as a child and gets taken in by a rebel of sorts. Same with Jin, loses her family and then gets taken in by Saw, a rebel. At one point, Cassian's gifted a kyber crystal, which he wears around his neck. Jin also has a kyber crystal that she wears around her neck. Interesting little nods. I don't think.
Wait, she has a kyber crystal? I don't remember that.
Yeah, her mom gave her a kyber crystal.
Oh, I didn't realize that was what. Okay.
That's how Chirrut, like, singled her out. He was like,
oh, right.
Would you trade that necklace you're wearing for.
Oh, you're right. I didn't put that together. Interesting. Jin sees the message from her dad, you know, basically saying that there is a flaw in the Death Star, you know, and but she's the only one that sees it, essentially. You know, nobody else in the squad or in the rebellion sees that message, and she has to go back and essentially convince the rebellion that they need to go on this suicide mission to get these plans. And it was a hard sell. Like, this lady that they don't know, they don't really trust. She's like, I saw this message from my dad that you didn't see, but take my word for it. There's secret plans here and we need to go get them. And nobody really believes her, but Cassian feels forced to trust her. And so, you know, he basically signs on. He's like, okay, I believe you. Let's go. And I just kind of put down that I didn't get the feel. Cassian's not a trusting kind of guy. Like, especially not, I just met this lady and she's taken me on a suicide mission. Like, I thought that was kind of weird, their relationship, that he was so willing to go along with that.
Yeah, maybe I missed something there. But yeah, it did seem like, did he see the message from Galen? I don't think he was there.
No, it was only her and Saw.
Yeah, okay.
Like, if it had been one of the other members of the crew was like, okay, I'm willing to make that sacrifice, or I'm willing, let's go investigate, I would have been on board. But Cassian seems like the least trusting of anybody on that crew.
But,
and he was the first one to speak up. So, I don't know. That one seemed a little strange to me.
No, there's some contextual stuff. Maybe he didn't see the message specifically. I will grant that. But he knows that there's a message. He knows that it was given from Galen to a pilot who was going to defect to the rebellion to smuggle that information over to Saw. That message is clearly something that's to the benefit of the rebellion. It's a message meant for them to help them.
Okay.
I mean,
so he doesn't necessarily know the details, but he knows that there is a message and he's putting two and two together that this is likely.
It's not a total leap of faith for him to be like, okay, strange right. girl who I've okay. known for 5 days, let's do this. Like, there's some legitimacy to the intel he's gathered.
Okay, good point. When they are on, I forget. What's the planet where Galen is, where their plans are? Is that Jeddah?
I think that's Edu.
Edu. Yeah,
when they are on Edu and, you know, Cassian is going out and he's going to maybe snipe Galen or so, one of the squad, I think it's Chirrut Emwe, I don't remember, but he says, the Force moves darkly near a creature that's about to kill.
Does he look like a killer?
No. He has the face of a friend.
Who are you talking about?
Captain Andor.
Why do you ask that? What do you mean? Does he look like a killer?
The Force moves darkly near a creature that's about to kill.
His weapon was in the sniper configuration.
And so he's asking if Cassian is a killer. So I thought that was kind of interesting because we know, as the audience, we know Cassian is a killer. Like, he has straight up killed several people, you know, and not necessarily always bad guys. So, you know, maybe there's an implication here that, you know, the blind guy is more sensitive to the Force and he sees some weirdness around Cassian because he's not a traditional good guy. He's not, you know, the all white wearing robe Jedi kind of guy. He's, you know, clearly somewhere in between.
So. Well, he's ordered by his commanders to kill Galen.
Yeah, Nuge. Well,
but he's already killed a bunch of other people.
Nuge.
That no one ordered him to kill.
Tear it up. This scene sucked. I grant you full license to just rip this to shreds.
When he just decides not to kill him?
The whole concept of the scene, the Force moves darkly around someone who's about it. No, that's a BS excuse to get Jin out of the shuttle to go follow Cassian, because that's where the story needs to go. It was bad writing. It was a poor setup. It didn't make any sense. It doesn't follow any of the logic that we know about Cassian up until this point. Does he look like a killer? Yeah, we absolutely know he's a killer. We watched him execute an ally in his very first scene in this movie. We know the dude's a killer. To have any sort of doubt around the fact of whether he would be willing or able to kill is absurd. It's a poorly written scene. So now that I've just said half of it, go ahead, Nooch, tear it apart.
Wow. I'm not as hard on that scene as you are, but yeah, that's a good point. Like, you have to have some reason for Jin to want to go out there. I found it satisfying enough to just like have her want to go see her dad, you know?
Yeah. That would have made more sense. Sorry, please continue.
It's fine, but yeah, we already knew that that was his mission, and I found that the fact that he just was like aiming and didn't take the shot for some reason, like he's a cold-blooded killer, like you said, like why wouldn't he just take the shot? There's no explanation. There's no turn of events for him to like suddenly.
There's no additional context or information given to us that would make us understand why he's not taking that shot. It's just an absolute, makes no sense given the context of the character that they've shown us to this point.
Yeah, right. I found that there's many of these types of unexplained confusion points for me.
But no, you're wrong about all the others, but this one, yeah, you're absolutely right.
So since we know that this movie was 50% rewritten and reshot by Tony Gilroy, it's safe to assume this was not a Tony Gilroy scene.
I honestly got that impression that this was one that was not written by Tony Gilroy and was distinctly written by someone else. That you had two different writers with two different takes on this character.
Mm-hmm. I didn't have a major problem with this scene. I mean, you're right. You do point out some flaws. I did like the idea that perhaps the Force behaves differently around someone that's about to kill, like that somehow it senses that, or it provides power or takes power away. Who knows? I just thought that was an interesting line. I kind of get off on the Force stuff and what it can and can't do. So I thought that was neat.
Cassian says something about the Force. He says something, I can't remember exactly, like I guess the Force and I just don't get along very well or something like that. Yeah, it's kind of funny. His relationship with the Force is kind of non-existent in Andor. And I get the feeling that Tony is not like chomping at the bit to like include the Force in his, you know, his show, but who knows.
We've talked about it a couple of different times, but the mysticism that Rogue One uses around the Force, the whole, you know, the temple, Donnie Yen's whole character is all mystic and religious almost. It's interesting that they turned back to that, because this movie followed up the prequels where they turned the Force into basically science bacteria.
Right.
So it was almost like a notable shift back to a mysticism and spiritualism about the Force rather than biology.
Totally. I would have liked to have seen more of Chirrut's character, more like, I mean, it was kind of like a one-note character. He just kind of comes out of the blue and he's just helping. And I mean, I do really like that concept of the Force not just being for Jedis. It's a spiritual element that anybody can access. And yeah, it's more democratic that way. I really liked that. I just think that there was too many elements in this in the movie overall that none of them really got their full shake. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I could see that. I did find watching this all through a second time, the Guardian characters, Baze and Chirrut, were really underdeveloped, underutilized. They were cool concepts for characters that just didn't get enough screen time to really explore. That said, they put Ip Man in a Star Wars movie, and I'm going to geek out about that. So,
am I the only one that wants to see a Chirrut and Baze buddy cop comedy spinoff show?
Do it. Make it so. Hire Dan Gilroy.
I'd be down. Dan. As much as you shit talk Dan.
So just to get back to some more tie-ins to Andor, Cassian mentions that he has been in this fight since he was six. Mm-hmm. So I assume that means that he was about six in season one of Andor. So he's basically saying that he's been doing this, you know, his whole life.
Yeah. One of the, I think maybe two or three character moments for him in the movie. You get a little, you get like a little sense of him being jaded and been kind of running from, I don't know, the running from the Empire or just kind of being, I don't know, didn't have a childhood. Yeah. Like you don't get much from his character.
I really liked, though, like when he says, I've been in this since six, I now have events to put context to that. You know, it reminds me of, you know, how he lost his family, how he was taken in by Marva, how he resisted, how he got arrested, all of that.
Yeah.
That statement now has so much more behind it. I really enjoyed having that this go around.
You know, I would have, if it weren't for one other line that he has in the Saw's prison where Chirrut says, oh, we've been in worse cages before, and Andor says, oh, this is my first time.
He's praying for the door to open.
It bothers him because he knows it's possible. Baze Malbus was once the most devoted guardian of us all.
I'm beginning to think the Force and I have different priorities.
Relax, Captain. We've been in worse cages than this one.
This is a first for me.
Yeah.
Like, he's straight up lying about his backstory there.
Oh.
So, like, you can't,
yeah.
Now that I know he was lying there, I almost can't trust what he says in other elements. So, like, so I have to assume, like, story-wise or character-wise, he was lying about that for some reason. And then that tells me that he's willing to lie to his close friends or, you know, about anything, I guess, his backstory or whatever. I don't know. It's a weird little thing that
it doesn't fit.
Tony could have cut. Yeah, he could have cut that out.
Yeah, I agree.
What did you guys think about, we talked about it in Andor, that Melshi, you know, escapes prison with Cassian. You know, they're the only two essentially maybe that make it to the beach. And we talked about him being in Rogue One on that episode, but I didn't remember Melshi's character at all. And when he shows up here, I was like, oh, it's cool. It's, you know, I guess it's good to see Melshi again. They tied back into Andor. But like, even in this, like Melshi's like a throwaway character. Like he does end up blowing up, you know, the beach as a distraction. And, you know, I guess he has a couple beats, but like of all the characters to bring over from Rogue One, it just seemed weird that Melshi was the one that made the cut because he's kind of forgettable.
I have a theory about this, but I defer, Nuj. Do you have any comments on it?
Oh, I just think I think he's looking for a character that in the movie that they may have a close connection with. It seems like from the jump they know each other and they've kind of trust each other. It may be one of the few people in Rogue One that it seems like Andor already kind of trusts. And you know, he's a prominently named character. I don't think there's anybody else that comes from those rebel groups that like the other rebel dudes that kind of join their mission that he kind of talks to and names. So I think that's probably what he's going off of.
Yeah. That kind of holds with the theory that I had, which was essentially they throw in this random named character in the last quarter of the movie during the final climactic, you know, fight scene. And they use his name repeatedly. And he has some speaking lines. And he has a couple of close-ups. Is he a major character? No. But he's not a throwaway, like, background character at that point. He's somewhat significant, and yet this is the first time we've even heard the name Melshi through the entire movie. Mm-hmm. So I think they made an effort in season one to explain, okay, who the hell is Melshi, and why is he important, and Cassian trusts him to lead this squad. Like,
yeah.
Okay, now we finally have some backstory to who the hell this Melshi character is.
Yeah, man, what I wouldn't give to, like, know the, like, the behind the scenes of what happened in this movie. Like, is Melshi a character that Tony created from whole cloth just to give some, like, dimension to Andor? Or is he someone that had a lot more in the movie and it got cut? Because it seems like a lot of stuff got cut. But I would love to know if there was, like, a tell-all book or something someday. But
yeah, they had to
Tony,
cut
Tony
out.
Gilroy, if you...
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, clearly Tony Gilroy's listening, so shoot us an email. You can come on the podcast and explain all this.
My theory, Tony had it written down. In fact, they had it filmed, but they had to edit it in post to make more runtime available for C-3PO and R2-D2 to have a cameo.
Oh, don't even get me started. That was so dumb.
I hated that. It was stupid.
I hated it, too. It was so
dumb. They're hitting basically 90% of the beats of Star Wars, then, like, what are they missing? Luke Skywalker. They had
the whole adding C-3PO was just like, it was, you know, whatever, one line, two lines. It was totally unnecessary. It was just stupid. It was like, it didn't need to be there.
See, you guys are pretty much in agreement with a lot of my qualms of this movie. I'm curious what you guys' scores are.
All right, so we're basically at the end of the movie here. I did note that, you know, when they're doing the big beach fight scene, that there are shore troopers on the beach. So I believe this is the first time we actually officially see shore troopers. I thought it was in the planet on Andor when Cassian gets arrested, but we actually see them here too. Yeah, they're quick and it's kind of a throwaway, but they're that are kind of the dirty tan looking, you know, stormtrooper kind of things.
Yeah. I do think this last third up until like maybe 2 minutes before the end is kind of the best section of the movie. This is a really great action chunk, and seeing, you know, you get to see some like AT-ATs get taken down, which I really appreciated. I got a new appreciation. Although it's not like new to this movie, but like the design of the AT-ATs or the AT-STs have these like really long legs, I guess to be sort of all terrain, but they're like pretty vulnerable and they're like kind of on stilts. And I guess it's sort of the hubris. It kind of represents the hubris of the Empire in that, you know, they don't really pay attention to its weak points. They just load it up with, they think the firepower will be enough for these things to be unstoppable. But you always see them getting taken down by these long, lanky legs. So I like that.
Well, the Ewoks take out an AT-AT.
AT-ST.
Right. AT-ST. Right. I mean, the point is that...
Yeah, you think they update the design on the... Yeah.
What did you guys think about, Cassian, in essence, saving the day, you know, because Krennic is just about to kill Jyn, and Cassian shows up behind him and shoots him, you know, sort of, I guess, redeems himself, saves the day. And then ultimately, you know, they end up down on the beach and then he dies. So, now that we know what we know about Cassian from Andor, what did you think about that? I wasn't sure if I was sold on that scene. It seemed a little tacked on, like Jyn's just about to save the day. Krennic shows up and like you need a little deus ex machina. And oh, what do you know? Cassian's right behind him.
Yeah, I didn't like this whole like the ending of the movie. I didn't like. Yeah, I can't really explain why. It just didn't seem like a good character moment for Cassian and Jyn at the end. I'm fine with like the surprise shot coming out of nowhere. That's a fine little twist. That part didn't bug me, but I guess I can't really explain just them going down to the beach and like suddenly embracing. I would have preferred them trying, you know, anything they could to like get out of there, you know, and then just dying on their way out, like fighting to the death, man. Come on.
Did you put the episode of Andor that ends with Melshi and Cassian on the beach where Melshi says we need to split up? And then Starwipe, like that's the end of the episode where they're standing on the beach looking out at the ocean. I got total vibes for that.
Totally.
For when Jin and Cassian were watching, in essence, this mushroom cloud come in. So it was very close. I had to ask Doug earlier. I'm like, what episode was that in? Because that's exactly how Rogue One ends. It would have been, but clearly that's not how Andor ends. Andor ends differently. I was just wondering if they ended similarly, but obviously not. But it was a very similar looking shot, I should say.
Yeah. I think there's just a little bit of homage there, just like him looking into the sunset.
That's the end of my notes as far. I mean, clearly there's a lot more going on in Rogue One, but, you know, as far as stuff that ties back to Andor, those are the points that I hit. Did you guys have anything else?
What did you think of Vader? We didn't even mention Vader.
I mean, you're talking about this scene at the end where he comes in and kills it. I love that scene. It's great. It's just
it was cool.
All the Vader scenes, I guess. Yeah.
That's the Vader that is fantastic. And that's the Vader that you never see in the on screen. You see Vader, or you see people's reaction to Vader in the original trilogy, and they all kowtow to him and they're all afraid of him. And you look at him, you know, especially after the reveal where you see him with his suit off and he's just this frail old man, but still he's leading this army and these people clearly look up to him. So seeing him, I guess, in essence, in his prime and holding no quarter and just straight up executing people, choking people, slamming dudes into the ceiling, cutting dudes in half, that was fantastic. That I think we needed a little bit more of in Star Wars, and that's definitely fleshed out in the books. You know, Vader's character backstory he is just super dark and just straight up executes entire plan. I mean, very, you know, analogous to Hitler, like no emotions, just I'm going to kill everybody, like whatever, you know, is if I need to get from A to B and you're between there, I don't care what it is, I'm getting you out of the way.
Yeah, and the women and the children too.
I think that I loved seeing that scene. The CG on that was really cool. It was really well done. You know, the one guy like has the chip and he, you know, hands it to the other guy through the door and then they close the door. You know, like there's tension in that scene. You know, I love the ending of the movie. I mean, the way it ties directly into, you know, the opening of New Hope. I don't think you could have asked for a better opening or ending.
100% agree.
I'm going to give credit to Tony Gilroy. He must have written that scene because it was great.
Yep. Oh, I will also point out those guys who Vader was just absolutely slaughtering as he was making his way down the hallway and through the ship. They were fighting till the end, Nooch. Did you appreciate their deaths?
Yeah, I actually appreciated the scene a little bit more than the first time I saw it. I thought it was like basically a video game. You know, the first time I saw it, I thought, why is Vader in this movie? He doesn't really play an important role. It's just like he's kind of maybe, you know, like Krennic is trying to suck up to him. And then at the end, like he finally shows up to like help out and wipes a bunch of dudes out trying to get to prevent them from, you know, moving the hard drive from point A to point B. You know, it was cool. It was definitely an effective scene. And that scene in a better movie would have been appreciated.
I don't know if that scene is necessary. I think it's a cool ass scene and I think it's great. You know, could the movie have just ended with, you know, the rebels throwing a party that they have these plans? You know, absolutely. I think, you know, throwing Vader in there doing badass Vader things, is that fan service? Yeah. But in that particular case, I think it was done really well. And the way that the scenes dovetail, you know, immediately into New Hope. That was one piece of fan service I did not have a problem with. Like, I could have done without C-3PO all day long, but that scene of Vader doing Vader things was great. I did not have a problem with it. I thought it was a good, you know, cap on the end of the movie.
Yeah. Right there with you.
Well, we've been talking for about an hour. So I guess the question is, I don't necessarily want to rate Rogue One because I think that's been done and we've talked about that before. I want to know if having seen season one of Andor and now having watched Rogue One, if it changes your enjoyment level of Rogue One. Who wants to go first?
I can. Yeah, I think I mentioned a few times where it like definitely improved. I think seeing Cassian in a very, it seems like a more jaded, desperate state, even more so than him in Andor, is interesting. And to know that's where he's coming from is is an improvement. Like, it's almost like part of the movie that wasn't there before. So, yeah, I gave it like half a point for that. And then I specifically the Mon Mothma stuff. Although there wasn't a whole lot of it.
I'm surprised you like that Mon Mothma stuff because it was so short. I mean, there's not a lot to it.
Yeah. No, you saw her like dealing with, you know, the rebel groups and dealing with Jin, and just some moments there with her I found to be more powerful because of what we know about her. And like just the kind of – they're not in a good state, like especially with – I felt more empathy towards her, I guess, as a character because of the backstory we know. So yeah, there was a couple points that were interesting to see in a different light.
Would it be fair to say that you hated this movie before you saw Andor? You were pretty violently opposed to it.
Well, I guess I just, you know, everyone seems to love this movie or really likes it. So I, you know, I'm a little bit of a contrarian and so, like, I didn't get it, and I'm like, there's just so many flaws people wanted to overlook, so I kind of feel like I have to fight for the cause of this movie's not that good. I think the first two thirds are boring, and the last – oh, I wanted to mention one thing real quick. In the last action sequence, I just had a question. Like, there's a whole moment with Bodhi, the pilot, trying to connect this communication system, and it was the whole part where – Chirrut has to like walk through.
Oh yeah, I know what you're gonna say.
That moment, and he has to activate the master switch, and it was a whole to do just to tell the rebels to try to blow up the gate, right? Which they were already doing, right? Was there any more to that than?
Well, I don't know if they were attacking the shield gate.
They were.
Right? They were just waiting for the shield gate to open, weren't they?
No, all those X-wings, I think, were firing at the gate. Beforehand, they were like kind of bouncing off of it. They were trying to open it already, seems like.
All I know is that scene where they crash a Star Destroyer into the gate, actually they crashed two Star Destroyers into it, that was awesome.
Yeah, that was cool.
I do think that was cool, yeah.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say about the master switch or the power, like the power switch essentially to this big gigantic thing is out in the middle of the sand. Like, why wouldn't it be on, you know, the panel that they were right next to? Like, clearly it has to be out in the middle because that's where all the bad guys are and you have to get shot at.
Yeah, there's so many things like that where like Jin has to go out to the end of this like platform to like load the ship in, and then she has to go back to the middle to like press the red button, I guess.
So I want to know, so if it's safe to say you pretty much hated this before Andor, where does it stand now that you've seen Andor?
I mean, I don't – hate is a strong word, you know? I don't like the movie. I still don't like it. I think it's not very good. I don't get a lot from it, so I do – like. Okay. There's definitely good moments. K2, I do like. There's some good action moments. I think Krennic is pretty cool as a character. As basically a two-dimensional villain, but I think that actor is pretty rad. But the main characters, all of them are so flat and like just not getting anything from them. Jin as the main character is so uncharismatic and bland, and like you just don't get anything from her. It's such a detriment to the movie for me because that's important for me is to have some good central characters that you can identify with. So I don't know. Does that answer your question?
So it sounds like you like it a little bit more, but it's still not your favorite.
Sure. I gave it a couple more. I gave it like half a point.
Okay. Doug, what about you? Now that you've seen this, now that you've seen Andor, does Rogue One move up or down in your book?
It definitely moves up. I mean, yeah, it added to the movie. There was a couple of instances where I found something from the series wasn't fully in line with what we were seeing in the movie, notably the prison. You know, this is my first time in a prison. Okay, no, that's a lie or an inaccuracy. Either way, it didn't really mesh. But for the most part, it was all kind of positive. I have a better understanding of the brutal pragmatism of Cassian. He will kill someone if it's to complete his mission to protect himself or his family. I understand that better now. The whole ending sequence with Melshi, I understand that. I also want to throw in there, There was a line after they sent the signal, after it got through. Cassian turned to Jen and said, "Do you think anyone is listening?" And that was like, oh, okay, I get it. The whole callback to the nobody's listening from the prison. I get that.
That was a cool connection you made. I did not make that, so good for you.
But yeah, it was overall positive. Did it drastically improve my outlook on the movie? I don't know. Maybe a little bit. What I did note, though, is there were parts of it that actually made me more interested in the series. Because now that we've seen how Andor will go into the backstory and explanation of these characters or events. Okay, you see the ragtag Rebel Alliance. How did they get there? Now I want to see. Now I want to know. You see where the Alliance ends up. Okay, Mon Mothma is now in the head of this ragtag Alliance. How? What happens? Where's Luthen? What happens to Luthen? She's now leading the whole group, but they're kind of a loosely organized group. Cassian is now a captain. Oh, okay, so they're loosely organized, but they have a rank structure? And he's a captain in Rebel Intelligence, which means they have different departments? So,
well, I mean, they do have an entire fleet. I mean, they've got a bunch of ships, yeah, so I guess, yeah.
I'm interested in the show to see how do we get there? Where do we get to that point? Why are they organized? How did the rank and structure come about? Did Luthen do that? Was he the first general? I mean, there's things that I'm curious about that I'm looking forward to the show, hopefully, explaining and taking on.
There's potentially a lot of runway left for season two. I wasn't sure exactly where it was going to go. And yeah, now that I've watched Rogue One, it is interesting to see, you know, where they could go. You know, with some of the characters, we could get some Saw and Jin action. We could get some, you know, organizational structure in the rebellion. Clearly, the rebellion is going to get more fleshed out. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of potential. I'm with you. You know, I watched this and I was expecting, now that I had seen the show, that I was going to, I loved Rogue One the first time I saw it. And I was watching it expecting to love it even more. And it didn't happen. I mean, the movie's great. I don't think it's significantly better having seen Andor. I mean, you could easily watch this movie and enjoy it without ever having seen Andor. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a good basis. If you liked Andor and you haven't seen Rogue One, then it's absolutely worth a watch. But, you know, otherwise, you know, you're fine on its own. So that was kind of what I took away from this. I mean, I would give this movie a solid. I really like this movie. So as far as Star Wars movies goes, this is one of my favorites.
And K2 is the best droid.
And we all agree on that. So, yeah, for sure.
Where are you taking these prisoners?
These are prisoners.
Yes, where are you taking them?
I am taking them to imprison them in prison.
He is taking us to...
Quiet! And there's a fresh one if you mouth off again.
We'll take them from here.
That's okay. If you could just point me in the right direction, I can take them, I'm sure. I've taken them this far.
Take them away.
Wait, you can't take them away.
You, stay here. We need to check your diagnostics.
Diagnostics? I'm capable of running my own diagnostics, thank you very much.
I mean, you know, it's slim pickings, because, I mean, you got C-3PO, who's just super whiny. I mean, R2-D2's great, but he doesn't really talk. And he can't really walk. And then you got what? I mean, who else is left? B2MO is not particularly great. BBA, I don't know. I mean, yeah, K2SO, great droid.
You don't like the emo droid?
Well, he's not as good as K2. I'm just saying, when we say K2SO is the best droid, I mean, that's definitely true because he's badass, but there's not a whole lot. It's not a big competition, I should say. Well, I think that's all we really have. So I think we'll wrap this up, but we will be back for season two of Andor. Has it started filming yet?
Yes, they did. They started the end of this last year. I think it's going to be like 2024, though, when it comes out.
Yeah, I think I heard it was going to be another 12 months before it's on the air. So
yeah, I'm okay with that.
Well, whenever that happens, we will be back. And just to stir the pot a little bit, I'm going to use the last word is the quote from the movie is, "We've been in worse cages than this one." He never says prison. So if you're playing devil's advocate, you could look at the prison that was on Narkeena 5. There were no bars there, and it was definitely not a cage. So perhaps Cassian was right. Maybe he's never been in a cage. All right.
Not convinced.
All right. Logic Gate out.
Did you just steal the outro?
I did. I was thinking about that after. I wonder if that was a specific design choice that they made for Narquina 5, that everything's electrified and there are no bars. It's a very non-traditional prison.
Just to, like, compensate for that one.
Just to get away with that line, maybe? Oh, maybe. Man. I don't know.
I think it's potentially more likely that they just forgot that that line existed.
Yeah.
Or conveniently looked the other way that that line existed.